Today is June 9, 2022. We're here for our second of three oral cases on our calendar this morning, A21-1400 State versus Johnson. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. These matters are being recorded. No other recording devices are allowed in the courtroom. And please identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument. And with that, we're ready to proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Joseph G. Vaccaro. I hear for Mr. Johnson. This case presents a very basic question of black letter law and its application. Minnesota Statute 60905 very clearly states that it triggers liability only when the person is alleged to have aided and abetted the crime of another. The black letter law continues in plain language to indicate that this statute contemplates crimes committed by a person other than the defendant when it talks about the actions that must be taken in respect to another, and in subdivision 3, when it clearly describes that a conviction is still possible under the statute even when the person who directly committed the offense has not been convicted of it. The district court erred in its application of the law because it essentially found that Mr. Johnson was liable under an indeterminate or alternate theory of liability that doesn't exist in statute. It impermissibly lowered the state's burden in proving Mr. Johnson's guilt by allowing him to be convicted in more ways upon less evidence. The state in its brief essentially argues that Minnesota has a common law doctrine of aiding and abetting instead of a statutory doctrine, and it relies primarily on Atkins, Belcourt, and Dobbins in making that assertion.
That's the very difficulty you have with your case, is there's no Minnesota case law that says that you can't be convicted of both. I mean, how do you distinguish the plethora of cases, Atkins, the others that you're reciting, how do you distinguish the circumstances here from those holdings?
Those holdings all involve direct evidence cases. In Atkins, there was testimony received that Atkins had been the shooter. If Atkins was the shooter and testimony was received to that, that testimony would be taken as true by the jury, and it would have been fruitless for him to attempt to raise a sufficiency of the evidence claim because the evidence was sufficient to convict him as a principal. In Belcourt, I would submit Belcourt is just wrongly decided when one reads the facts of that case. The victim finds himself approached by three men on the street. He's unconscious. His wallet is missing. He identifies Belcourt as one of the three men who approached him on the street, but there's no facts contained in that opinion that indicate.
What I read in your briefing is, and I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around this, is that what you are really arguing is the overall fundamental unfairness of our accomplice liability statute. Is that kind of where you're going with this? That someone who could be a lesser player to the activity can be as held as per statute as guilty as the actual perpetrator?
No, my contention here is simply that the state must consider what it has to prove when it charges out under 60905. There are ways in which people can be convicted and sent to prison for the rest of their life for things that aren't even criminal under 60905. If they were to, say, give the defendant a key to a building so they might enter and commit a first-degree murder or open a door. What I'm simply contending is that when the state looked at the facts of this case, it knew that under the circumstantial evidence standard, it could not hold any of these three co-defendants liable as a principal. And so it chose to rely on 60905 and ignored the plain statutory language that requires liability under that statute to attach when the crime is proven to be that of another. Now, I will concede.
Are you suggesting we overrule Atkins? Because that seems to me to be on point with what this case is all about.
No, I'm not. I'm suggesting that the language in Atkins regarding 60905 is actually dicta and is describing the work that the felony murder doctrine does. Now, the felony murder doctrine is faulty here because Minnesota lacks the merger doctrine. So it's undisputed that Mr. McGill was assaulted, but he didn't experience a single assault. He experienced three assaults. He was assaulted by Mr. Johnson, Mr. Johnson's brother, and their friend, Mr. Stevenson. And the only one of those assaults that was alleged to have caused the death is the first-degree assault. Mr. McGill died of stab wounds. And if it, and if Mr. Johnson, Mr. Christopher Johnson, was the one who inflicted those stab wounds, he would be the person who directly committed the crime. The predicate felony would not be the crime of another. It would be his own crime. What this goes to is that the state needs to be careful when it chooses its charges.
I mean, are you drawing a distinction between the type of conviction that can be achieved in a direct evidence case versus a circumstantial evidence case? Because we treat that evidence the same way for purposes of a conviction.
We treat the evidence the same way in terms of the court doesn't prefer one or the other.
Yeah.
But a conviction based purely on circumstantial evidence does require heightened review.
Yes, on appeal, yes.
Yes, and also according to the Al Nasir Silvernail body of case law upon the defendant's motion for directed verdicts.
I mean, I am troubled by the following scenario. When you have a group of people who have assaulted a person and the person dies and all of them start pointing the finger at each other, it seems like the logical conclusion of your argument is that none of them can be held liable.
That's not true. If they start pointing the finger at each other, they are to take the stand and the jury makes a credibility determination about who did what. This problem has existed for as long as the criminal law exists, and this is primarily why the law of riot exists. Riot doesn't take into consideration what you actually did. All the state is tasked with proving is that you participated in a riot. And first-degree riot seems to me to cover that situation perfectly.
So they can't be responsible for a murder. They can only be responsible for a riot?
They could be responsible for a murder if the state could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the testimony of an individual as to who did what is sufficient to prove that to a jury. If evidence could come back that could tie, say, if the victim died of a stab wound to a knife that was wielded by one of the participants, that would be sufficient evidence. Same with ballistics. It doesn't preclude a conviction. It's just a complicated factual scenario which requires more evidence, which requires the state to produce evidence to prove its case.
I was troubled by something that you wrote in your reply brief on page 7.
Okay.
Where you talk about the cases that the state cites and say that they were at best inapplicable or at worst wrongly decided. Well, they're Minnesota Supreme Court cases and we're bound to follow them. So I'm not exactly sure what you want us to do with that suggestion.
Well, my suggestion is that all of those cases were decided on legal questions other than those presented by subdivision 1 of the statute. No one has ever approached the court asking the court to determine what the plain language of subdivision 1 requires. And I would submit that that's because of the unique factual circumstances in this case. The evidence in a case almost always consists of people pointing the finger at each other and credibility determinations being made by the jury. I could not find a single case where there was no finger pointing and no evidence that pointed to any of the individuals. All three of these men remained silent. The state did not recover any physical evidence or locate any witness who could tell us what each of these men specifically did. I did not mean to be dismissive of that case law. I just simply meant to highlight that the question of what subdivision 1 means has, in regards to the phrase crime of another, has not been brought before the court before.
But isn't your argument essentially the equivalent of finger pointing at someone, you know, the finger pointing situation? I mean, what you're saying is that somebody else could have been responsible for it, not your client.
Yes, but my argument is that in the finger pointing situation, the state bears the burden. And so if the state looks at its evidence and says, ooh, I can't overcome the finger pointing situation because I have no direct evidence, then the state needs to fall back on a different charge and a different theory of liability. The state is required by the Constitution to prove every fact necessary to sustain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that different theory of liability, in your view, is a riot?
Riot would have been one theory that could have been relied upon.
But it's not a murder charge.
You could charge felony murder through riot. The evidence in this case also indicated that the men were kicked out of the bar and then snuck back in, clearly with the intention to commit an assault. That would be grounds for burglary as a predicate felony for felony murder. for which all the men could be held liable as principals. The state's required to prove the facts necessary to sustain a conviction, not for some theory of liability that exists on the law, but for the theory of liability it puts down in the complaint. And this is a very narrow case with exceptional facts, but the state has failed to do so here.
This case is different than some of the cases that the parties cite in that this was a court trial. And so we don't have the kind of verdict you see with a jury, which is guilty or not guilty as principal, guilty or not guilty as an accomplice. Instead, we have the district court going through his reasoning for how he reached his verdict. Do you think the fact that this is a court trial distinguishes this case from other cases that you cite or the state cites?
I think it presents the court with different things to analyze in determining its verdict, but the state's burden remains the same, regardless of whether a case is tried to a jury or to a judge. And the Al Nassir-Silvernail analysis is still applicable. And I have not found any authority in Minnesota that allows someone to be convicted on a theory that they either were this or either were that. Either the person who directly committed the crime or a person who aids and abets it.
What's your best authority for the proposition of mutual exclusivity?
Having thought about that issue more and having reviewed some of the cases the state cites in its brief, there is not always a situation, it is not always the case that the charges are mutually exclusive. They simply need to be charged correctly. I would simply look at the Crow case. That's a companion case to the two Pendleton matters that the state cited. I think Crow represents an example of how if the felony murder doctrine is applied properly, a person could be liable both ways. In Crow, all of the co-defendants were charged with felony murder under a theory that the predicate felony was a kidnapping. And the evidence indisputably showed that all three had participated in a kidnapping. Thus, by kidnapping the victim, the defendant in that case was liable for first-degree murder as the principal or the person who directly committed the offense, and also as an accomplice because they aided and abetted the separate offense of kidnapping committed by one of their co-defendants. Again, the problem with the felony murder in this case arises from the unique fact that Minnesota has not adopted the merger doctrine, and the state specifically chose a predicate felony of first-degree assault, which could not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to have been committed by one of the co-defendants. I would also note that the case law isn't really clear on whether 60905 contains elements, because while we have Dobbins stating that 60905 is just a theory of liability and doesn't contain elements of an offense, and it does so in reliance upon State v. Britt, which simply talks about the sufficiency for an indictment, not the sufficiency of a conviction, we also have the holdings of McCook and Milton to contend with that state that 60905 does state elements, and that if an element of 60905 is admitted from the jury instructions, that constitutes plain error. And so when we think about the holdings of McCook and Milton, it does make sense. They say that different things have to be shown, and that specifically, in order to convict under 60905, it has to be shown that the defendant intended to aid others in the commission of the crime. If someone directly commits the crime, they plainly lack that mens rea. They intend to do it themselves. They don't intend to help anybody else in the commission of the offense. So again, this argument is a narrow one. It's in some ways perhaps a technical one, but it nonetheless is that we have to apply the plain language of the statute. We abolished the common law distinction between principals and accomplices in terms of punishment, but we cannot abolish the distinction between what they do. And when the legislature chose to codify that distinction, it chose quite specifically to say that accomplice liability attaches when a crime is committed by another. And we apply the plain language of the law, and we mandate that the state has to prove every fact necessary to sustain a conviction. and a fact necessary to sustain a conviction under the aiding and abetting statute is that the crime was directly committed by someone other than the defendant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Ed Stockmeyer, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. I have 2 points I want to make this morning, and then I'll move on to responding to some of the arguments that my friend just made. So first, in State versus Atkins, the Supreme Court could not have been any clearer about the scope of accomplice liability. It said the defendant could be prosecuted for murder under an accomplice theory regardless of who fired the fatal shots. That rule is clear, it is dispositive of the dispute in this case, and appellant has not offered any rational way to reconcile his proposed rule with that one. This court should affirm appellant's conviction for second-degree murder because the law of accomplice liability is such that he can be found guilty without regard to which man actually stabbed Mr. McGill. Now, although Atkins, precludes appellant's arguments in this case, I do want to propose another path to affirmance, one that actually doesn't require this court to reach these questions about the scope of accomplice liability. And that path is to simply just apply the well-worn circumstantial evidence standard of review. Under that standard, a conviction may only be reversed on sufficiency grounds if there is some reasonable inference other than guilt, that is, other than guilt of the crime of conviction. Claiming that you might have committed a second-degree murder, which is the claim in this appeal, is not an inference other than guilt. It is a claim that you are guilty of the very same second-degree murder that you are convicted of committing. So whatever this court thinks about the arguments that counsel and I may make this morning or the arguments in our brief, we have to all agree that appellant is not entitled to a reversal of his conviction under the applicable standard of review, and that is because he cannot offer any inference other than guilt that can be reasonably drawn from the circumstances proved. That is all this court needs to say in order to affirm the conviction in this case. Turning to appellant's arguments this morning, I heard on a number of occasions appellant rely on the existence of conflicting evidence at trial about who the actual killer was. I think Dobbins would be an example where that was the evidence. The problem with that argument is that the sufficiency standard says we disregard the conflicting evidence. We only assume the evidence that supports the state's case. And then after we sort of call down the circumstances proved by applying that standard, we then ask what can be reasonably drawn. So what constitutes sufficient evidence can't turn on, in one case there was conflicting evidence and in another case there wasn't. It always turns on what was the evidence most favorable to the state and what circumstances can we draw from that. Another point I'd like to address is that my friend said that this is a unique case in which the state was unable to identify a particular person as the direct perpetrator of the murder. I think that's just untrue. If you look at all the cases we cite in our brief, both the ones I discuss in detail and the ones I just provide parenthetical citations for, most of them involve this type of situation where it is unclear exactly who inflicted the fatal wounds. They are all charged and prosecuted as accomplice liability. This is not a unique case.
When you say that it's not a unique case, I assume that you do not think there's any precedential guidance that this court, could fashion as far as this being a precedential determination one way or the other?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think this should be an unpublished decision. I think this involves routine application of the well-worn accomplice liability doctrine. In particular, if you look at Atkins, Judge Frisch, I'd like to, on that point, turn to a comment you made about appellant's argument really being about finger-pointing. Well, that's what was at issue in Atkins. What I want to emphasize about the finger-pointing here that I think is so remarkable is this isn't a case where a defendant comes to an appellate court and says, my co-defendant and I, we each blamed each other. We each pointed the finger in the opposite direction. This is a case where the defendant is coming to this court and saying, I might have committed this murder, and my conviction for murder should be reversed because I might have committed this murder. I am not unaware of any conviction in this state being reversed under those types of circumstances, where the only alternate inference is that you committed the crime. Those are both inferences of guilt, and that is because under the doctrine of accomplice liability, there is one conviction. You are guilty of murder. There's an accomplice theory, there's a principal theory, but it's one crime. They are not distinct offenses.
Do you want to address counsel's argument that this is sort of in a different realm because he's making a statutory interpretation argument as opposed to relying on the common law?
Your Honor, I agree that appellant's best argument is the word another in the statute. And in all candor, I don't have a strict textualist response to that. I can't point to another phrase in the statute that sort of suggests another means something else. What I can say is, yes, we now have criminal statutes. We're not operating under a criminal common law, but those statutes have been, the current version has been in effect since 1963. This is not the first time somebody has, an appellate court has been tasked with interpreting and applying the accomplice liability statute since 1963. It's not even the first time that a defendant has come to an appellate court and made exactly this sort of argument, as exemplified by the cases we rely on, Atkins, Dobbins, and Belcourt. So regardless of what we might think, if this was a new statute and we were reading it for the first time and we say, oh, the word another, that must mean something in particular, we're standing on all the precedent of the prior cases. And in particular, I want to emphasize that when we're talking about statutory interpretation, that's when adherence to precedent, stare decisis, is supposed to be sort of at its pinnacle of weight. You have to provide extra reasons to actually depart from prior interpretations of the statute where the legislature has sort of continued that statutory language to be in effect. An appellant simply hasn't done that here. I guess I will end with a final point, and that is that adopting appellant's proposed rule would incentivize concerted effort crimes. Work as a group. Make sure no witnesses can identify the actual killer, and you can get away with murder. That is not and has never been the law of accomplice liability in Minnesota, and this court should not make it so. The state simply asks that this court affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I want to begin by talking about the two standards that apply on appellate review, direct versus circumstantial. Atkins was a direct evidence case. Atkins defendant Dixon pointed the finger at Atkins and said Atkins did it. The jury took that as true when it convicted Mr. Atkins under a theory of principal liability. He attempted to challenge his conviction under principal liability under the direct evidence standard and quite obviously failed. He then attempted, under subdivision 2 of 60905, to challenge his conviction as an accomplice. He did not put the question before the court of crime of another. He put the question before the court of whether or not the murder was a foreseeable consequence of the aggravated robbery. And it obviously was, because he committed a robbery with a gun. The circumstantial evidence standard has never been approached before the court on a question of subdivision one. There has always been some direct evidence that pointed one way or another about what the defendant did. The most common way that 60905 comes before the court is when someone who was merely present at the scene contests that the evidence is insufficient to show that they intended their presence to aid the crime. And I would agree that there is a large body of case law under 60905, but that large body of case law does not address the plain meaning of subdivision one. I would also note, as counsel for the state noted, that this law has been in effect since 1963. The prior version of the statute before the 1963 revision of the criminal code did state that all persons concerned in the commission of a crime are principals. When the new law was enacted in 1963, the legislature very deliberately chose the language crime of another. This does not incentivize the commission of group of concerted liability crimes. It just simply states that they have to be charged out correctly. If you get together with your friends and you choose to commit a robbery and somebody dies in the course of that robbery, since the earliest days of criminal law, everyone who participates in that robbery is guilty of murder, provided the state charges felony murder robbery. If in that case, the state only charged murder with no reference to the robbery, and the state could not prove that your actions caused the death of that person, you would not be guilty of robbery because the state chose a defective charge. That's the basic thing that this case highlights, is the state needs to be careful when it's choosing its charges because it must prove everything that it has charged. The circumstantial evidence test doesn't ask whether you're guilty of some crime. It asks whether you're guilty of the crime charged. If someone is charged with auto theft and the state then proceeds to prove that they stole a bike and there was no lesser included charge of theft, no lawyer in the world would disagree that the evidence is insufficient to support a conviction for auto theft. In the same way, if someone is indicted for first-degree murder, and the evidence shows that the defendant killed the person and killed the person intentionally, but it is found that they lacked the premeditation, the person would have to be acquitted if only charged with first-degree murder. The burden is on the state to prove all facts necessary to sustain a conviction for the charges which they chose. And the plain language of the statutes governing the charges they chose require the crime to have been committed by another. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you very much for your arguments and your submissions. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.
Thank you.